born on the Nativity of Our Blessed Mother and celebrating 10 years on the air, The Winds of Change.
Marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., along with the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And it is my pleasure, as it is each Monday afternoon, to be sitting in here for Father Anthony to start out the week with you. Hope you all had a great weekend. Well, I am wearing a new mask today. I was joking with one of my girlfriends. When you see a fellow friend now, another woman, I love your mask, where have you gotten it, is the new I love your purse, where did you get it? So it's the new great fashion accessory, but I'm wearing one that's really special because it's unique in that it promotes a new film premiering this week, the Fatima film. I was able to go to a really special pre-screening of this movie, which is terrific, and I highly recommend, at Soldier Field, where they had a drive-in to premiere the film, and it was a benefit for the Daughters of St. Paul on Michigan Avenue, whose store was, of course, badly looted in the first round of rioting that we've seen so much of this summer, sadly. So I'm wearing my wonderful Fatima mask that was given to us as a little incentive to be there, and I'm so grateful to be joined this half hour by the producer of the film, Rose Ganguza. Rose, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Rose, the film is really remarkable, but I have a question just to sort of start out. There's so many films on Fatima, and some of them good, some of them, you know, a little bit better. Yours really takes a fresh and really interesting new take on it. What inspired you to make another film, especially when there are so many other ones about the same event out there?
Yeah, you know, it was something that was very personal for me. When I was approached on this film, two gentlemen from California came to me, and they had optioned rights to remake rights for the 1952 film. But they had a script which, for me, I didn't think spoke as well to today's audience.
Mm-hmm. In what way? Just pious, or?
No, not at all. I think the message of this movie is how the voice of a child can change the world, essentially. And I remember the nuns in Catholic school when I was in grammar school putting up the white sheet, and every year showing us that 1952 film, which if you look at it now, it's quite dated. But in 1952, it was actually nominated for an Academy Award.
Was it really? Oh, I didn't know
yes,
that.
Yes, it was.
Wow.
And I just love good stories, and I love history. And I thought, this has to be approached from the historical context as well as the religious context. In addition to which, I also always feel that that I wanted to tell the story from the eyes of the children.
Mm-hmm.
So in my mind, it was like, well, okay, if these kids who are living in Portugal at the time of the First World War, on the eve of a major worldwide pandemic. They were in fear all the time. People were being lost constantly to the war, sons, husbands, brothers, whatever. And if you don't look at the global occurrences of the time, and you don't understand where these children were and what kind of backgrounds they came from, it would be very difficult to understand how significant this was.
Right.
Also, at the time in Portugal, there was enormous anti-clericism. They were burning priests in effigies in squares. They were closing churches. And they were very pro-communist. And this was all a part of what was going on. So I said to them, look, I see this story more like Pan's Labyrinth than anything else. I said, we really, really need to approach this in a more global perspective. And I don't think that if they were walking in those pastures, that if they would have seen somebody floating in the air or anything else. I said, this woman who approaches them has to be different than anything that was surrounding them.
Mm-hmm.
Their parents were very nervous, and they didn't have a lot of money. And they were the mother in the film, obviously Lucia's mother, is very, very cruel in a way to her.
Yeah.
And it, at the beginning, doesn't really support her child because she's more worried in keeping her faith to make sure that her son comes back from the war.
Right.
And so all of this is a bit of folly. Plus, it puts them in a very difficult situation within the context of the village. And, of course, in those days, the priest and the religious community was very important to their day-to-day lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the script and I said, look, this is what I need for it to be. And the fact that these children kept saying to the Blessed Mother, we want to go with you, knowing that that would mean that they would have to die to go with her.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of is significant because why would they want to die if their lives on earth were so wonderful,
right,
you know?
Right.
And it's so all of that went into the rewriting of this script and bringing it to a point where I think now you don't have to just be a Catholic to appreciate the message of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we wanted. You want the Catholics, obviously. I'm a very religious person, and I believe in God. But there are a lot of people who don't. And when we made the film, of course, could never have expected that we would have been facing what we're facing now,
right,
in the world.
When was the film completed? So was it before we had...
We completed it, yeah. We completed it 2 years ago, right on the eve of Jacinta and being, you know, the two younger children being made saints.
Okay.
By the Vatican.
Francisco and Jacinta, yeah.
Lucia will take a bit of a while because,
right,
she died so old. She was almost 97 years old when she died. So obviously she's been beatified, but she's not been declared a saint yet.
Well,
I was also inspired by the fact when I found out that Mel Gibson, after he had done The Passion, had gone to see Lucia in Fatima and speak to her through the cloister window,
right,
and then bought a house in Fatima and named his little girl Lucia after her.
Oh, interesting.
And the Harvey Keitel character that we created is basically based on that encounter.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as I mentioned in my introduction, saw the film. It was just such a great gift to be there, you know, because I know they had such limited seats. And I was just so thrilled that I was included, not only to see the film, but also to be sort of a visible support to the Daughters of St. Paul. You know, Soldier Field being what it is, you know, we could hear it. But I'm going to have to rewatch it because I know that there's some of the dialogue that that I would have missed. But it was interesting. I have a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old, and we had just assumed they would want to go to a drive-in movie and see this great film on Fatima. But they had seen, I think it must be that 1950s version you're referencing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they said they did not want to go. They still, my 15-year-old said, Mom, I still have nightmares about that. And So I guess when I saw it, the scene of hell is really terrifying. And I think my teenager could have handled it, but I'm sort of glad I didn't bring my 12-year-old because I don't know without preparation how she would have absorbed that. And has the film been rated? And why? I mean, I guess I know why you would portray hell in the way that it was portrayed, because the children themselves said if our lady had not told us we were going to heaven, we think we would have died there on the spot. It was that awful.
And
it was interesting. I was talking to a friend afterwards who was also there and does not doubt at all, of course, the validity of the apparition. But he said, you know, I've always kind of wondered why Our Lady would do that to children, to show them that kind of vision of hell. Did you get, when you were filming that scene in particular, any insights, any feedback from other parents?
It's funny. I've done a lot of work with children over the years. I started the Audrey Hepburn Foundation when Audrey died, worked a lot over the years with UNICEF. And when I was doing the Audrey Hepburn Foundation, I went out and I had some very illustrious older actors on my board. But I said to Luca and Sean, Audrey's sons, I said, you know, we need to go to the young kids in Hollywood, you know, and teach them what it is about giving back, because God's given them so much. You know, and so I brought in all of these big kid actors at the time, like Natalie Portman and Jonathan Taylor Thomas, the Olsen twins, all of these kids. And I kept them always around me, and I would always talk to them. And they come to me today as adults and say, oh, we had so much fun in those days. You really taught us a lot, Rose, and stuff. But I like communicating with kids when I'm working with them. And these three children, who are all from Spain, I said to them, I said, you know, while we were shooting, I said, what would you say to people who are going to see this movie? And they said that people should listen to children when they talk.
Mm.
And I thought that was really interesting.
That's really profound,
Yeah, it was really profound. And I still think that. I think that there's a maturity in this that's not faked. The three actors who played these roles, who now are going on to really great things, all three of them are enormously talented, really believed in the message that we wanted to convey. And we didn't say anything to them.
Mm-hmm.
They just did their roles, and they became very close friends on set and are still very close today.
How many kids did you audition overall? Because I have to say, I thought the Lucia in particular.
Hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah, the Lucia in particular was really good. And
she's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, I've always had a heart for poor little Francisco about, you know, how he was not able to, he could see her, but he couldn't hear her. And maybe, you know, for those in our listening audience, Rose, who don't know the story, can you just do a very sort of Reader's Digest version, quick explanation of the apparition at Fatima? Because I always assume, you know, that everybody knows these things, and then people will post something on my social media saying, why didn't you ask her to explain? I should have started with that. But if you could just give a very brief overview.
Sure. In 1917, in a very small town called Fatima, which is north of Lisbon in Portugal, three shepherd children were out in the fields one day, and they saw a woman dressed in white who spoke to them, and it was the 13th of May, 1917. The world was in the middle of World War II, and of course, Portugal, like every other country in Europe, was involved in the war. A lot of people, a lot of soldiers were sent from Portugal to battle.
Right.
These three children, the the woman said to them not to say anything to anybody. Lucia, the older one, didn't say anything to her parents, but the two little kids, who were brother and sister, and
but they
her
were
cousin.
They saw an angel first, correct? The angel of Portugal appeared to them prior to Our Lady coming?
The angel appears to Lucia in a cave as she was praying for her brother to come back. And then this apparition happens. And the Blessed Mother says to them, come back next month on the same day, which was the 13th. As the word started to spread, people started coming from surrounding towns. In the middle of all of this, the Catholic Church felt that it was inciting the wrong kind of congregation. The Catholic Church came under a lot of scrutiny by public officials who were very left-wing at that time and leaning more towards communism. They, at one point, in the midst of all of this, they closed down the local church in Fatima, and they even put the children in jail for a few days. So every month, for 6 months, until October 13th, the Virgin appeared to them, and the crowds got bigger and bigger. By October 13th of 1917, the word had spread way beyond Portugal, and people showed up in what has now been called the Miracle of the Sun. And there were 70,000 people on that day in the grotto, and there is documentation of it by journalists and people who had those cameras at the time and everything else. And Lucia asked the Virgin to show people something that would show them that this was real, that she was really there. And in the course of the 6 months, she also gave them three secrets, which stayed at the Vatican well into the latter part of the 20th century. One secret had to do with the end of World War II. The second secret had to do with the onslaught of communism. And the third, which is a bit cloudy sometimes because there are a lot of conspiracy theories about it, but predicted what happened to John Paul XXIII of a man in white being shot.
John Paul II, yeah.
Yeah, and so there was that. And on the 13th of October, the sky got very, very dark, and all of a sudden the sun came out, and it seemed like the sun was just coming out after very bad rain, and then the sun started barreling towards the earth. And people started running in all sorts of directions. And then it receded. And that's what they call the Miracle of the Sun.
And the people had been soaked. And after the sun sort of appeared to be coming down to the sky, and then it went back up again. And again, this was all documented in secular newspapers.
Very much.
The people found their clothes dry. So really, really something. That Our Lady would not only, manifest herself in such a, dramatic way, but that it was really there for all to see. And a lot of, I believe, sort of instantaneous conversions happened. And so just a remarkable event that it was.
Today, on the site of Fatima, there are two cathedrals on either side of a very large square. And between 7 and 9 million people a year from all over the world go to Fatima for pilgrimages, and it's really a phenomenal place to see, and especially if you go on the 13th of any of the months, where a sighting had been, because they do an outdoor mass and very big processions, all the hotels in Fatima actually have facilities in the rooms for people in wheelchairs and people with physical disabilities, because a lot of people go there seeking miracles.
Right.
And my whole thing at the beginning is, well, what's the first message of this? And I think the message is that miracles can happen, and that we shouldn't be so distressed in our lives that we don't believe anymore in miracles, because without the belief in miracles, everything is just awful. If you can't believe that there's always something better that can happen, or that something good can happen from that, then you're going to live your life in a very sad way. And I, you know, and I wanted people to come out of this with some inspiration. I think the movie is perfect, even though this is not the way we wanted to premiere this film. I mean, we had a huge premiere scheduled with Andrea Bocelli at Lincoln Center for April 24th.
Yeah, he has a big devotion to her, doesn't he? To Our Lady of Fatima. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I first called him to ask him if he'd be part of the film, he said yes immediately. It was incredible, and he's never really done this kind of thing before.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, he was just incredible, and the music in the film, I think,
is beautiful,
gorgeous.
Yeah, it's absolutely a gorgeous musical setting for it, and the scenery is beautiful. And tell me a little bit about the actress who portrayed Our Lady. That was for me kind of one of the more striking. Portrayals of Mary, and you know, I'm sort of used to Song of Bernadette, and even I don't know if you've seen this new series, The Chosen. That's a very dramatically different portrayal of Our Lady, but of course, it's a very Protestant perspective. But tell me a little bit about the actress who played Mary and why you chose her. She's beautiful to begin with; she's absolutely stunning. But what was it?
Someone we interviewed Spanish and Italian and Brazilian and, you know, whatever. She's Portuguese. I said to the director, Marco, we need someone who is stunningly beautiful and that there's some, that we can kind of create some kind of aura around her, because she had to be someone, even the way she dressed and everything, had to be someone who was so different than anybody that was around. I mean, they were surrounded by women who were basically peasants, very hardworking, and, you know, there was nothing ethereal about them. They had to live the practical day-to-day of hard life.
Yeah, very hard life. No indoor plumbing.
And, you know, in an agricultural society.
Right.
So this woman had to be something so incredible that she seemed like she represented something like a children's heaven. And, it took us a long time. I mean, I think we must have seen hundreds and hundreds of actresses reading those lines and doing those lines. And we were shooting in Portugal in about over 100 degree temperatures.
Oh, my goodness.
And
yeah.
This poor girl had hay fever, so she was taking medication.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing. Well, Rose, we're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, I'd like you to let our listeners know how they can see the movie, and if they're a little nervous now about movie theaters, especially with the COVID, how they can go about watching this new film. So, listeners, please don't go away. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
It's been quite a year, hasn't it? Riots, businesses looted and burned, abortion up to the moment of birth, COVID-19 shutdowns, where churches are considered non-essential, and a false version of American history is being taught in schools. Yes, this is probably the most important election in our lifetime. The preservation of certain aspects of the Constitution is in jeopardy. What can be done? Pray and fast. Ask for the intercession of our Blessed Mother. Storm heaven with prayer. We can't tell you who to vote for, but we can tell you to vote the teachings of your faith. Winds of Change asks you to vote, preferably vote in person, but vote.
The Winds of Change. The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
New from EWTN Publishing, A Crisis in Culture, How Secularism is Becoming a Religion, by Father George Rutler. In this timely and penetrating book, Father Rutler shows how the West's decade-long cultural assault against Christianity is finally reaching its inevitable conclusion, the self-destruction of our culture and society. In Father Rutler's book, discover why the Catholic faith is the only means by which civilization can be restored, the difference between nostalgia and tradition, why the 20th century produced more martyrs than all previous Christian centuries combined, and what happens when we let the government, rather than the church, become our mother. These are some of the insights you'll gain in A Crisis in Culture, How Secularism is Becoming a Religion, Available now at EWTNRC.com. By Catholic. Shop EWTNRC.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change. And I have been privileged to have been joined for this segment by Rose Ganguza, who is the producer of a new film on Fatima, being released formally this week. Is that correct, Rose?
It's August 28th.
August 28th, so next week. So how do listeners in the time of COVID get to see this film? Do you have any theaters where it's going to be?
We are opening on, we were supposed to be opening on 1,000 screens in movie theaters, but as you know, a lot of movie theaters, because of the persistence of COVID, are not opening now. So there will be 250 screens across the country at AMC and Regal Cinemas, but on the same day, August 28th, we are going on to premium video on demand, and that means that you can rent this movie in your house and watch it with your family, and that will happen on August 28th. So we did that because so many people, when we put the trailer out the first time in May, 10 million people went on immediately and kept saying, when can we see this movie? And unlike a lot of film releases, we don't want to push this anymore because we think the time is right to put this into the world. So right. We are doing the premium video on demand.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's really been sort of a nice silver lining to the COVID cloud, is that you are able to access movies that you would normally have to wait for the theater premiere to be able to go and see, and you can see them from your home, which I think still a lot of people feel a little bit more comfortable with, particularly people who are older, you know, and may have, that might be one of the larger groups. Are you going to be making this available to Catholic schools? And
yes,
okay, that's wonderful. How will you approach the schools? And
so we have a specific group that we've been working with from the beginning. When I started this project, I went to Bob Burney and Jean Burney from Picture House. And, of course, Bob is most well-known for having been the person who created all the marketing and distribution for The Passion for Mel Gibson.
Okay.
And so from day one, he was really the person I wanted to distribute this movie, and he is. And they've reached out to all the archdioceses and to the Catholic schools. And they have a specific group that does this, that is reaching out to the schools and to the different Catholic communities across the United States and Canada to make sure that school children get to see it.
Okay. Well, I mentioned, you know, one of my questions, the age appropriateness of it. Has it been rated? And are you, when you're working with schools, what kind of grade ranges are you looking for?
Yeah, it's PG-13.
Okay.
There are parts of it that, you know, might, you know, give a little pause to younger children. And we were well aware of that. Yeah, it's PG-13.
Right. I mean, you want to be faithful to what the children saw. That's, you know, and you don't want to make hell look like it's not an unpleasant place. I'm not trying to make light of it, but it's a very fine line to walk, particularly with, you know, with children, that they're not, you know, that they're not. Yeah, I have a friend, you know, who's my age, who told me that when, you know, after the nuns in school had taught them about this particular apparition of Our Lady, that she would have nightmares that Our Lady was going to appear to her and show her something like that.
Oh, my God.
And
she just, I know. When we were in school, the nuns did that to us. They would say, on July 14th, the world is going to come to an end, but, you know, so-and-so in Hollywood's going to be scared because he's Catholic, and he's ready. They would say these things, and then, you know, your parents would find you under the beds on July 14th, and they'd go, go out and play.
Yeah, God, please don't, let me be one of the ones that's taken, but, you know, it's I think it's one of those things. It's like the crucifixion, right? And I think Mel Gibson had criticism of this, that it was unnecessarily violent, and a lot of the violence was gratuitous. But then you want to say, you know, the crucifixion was not a cakewalk. Yeah, the Romans were not known for being, you know, trying to put people to death mercifully. That's for sure. And it really is. Again, I my hat's off to you as a producer to. I think have walked that line well, although, you know, listeners, those of you who do have children, maybe I would say under maybe 13, watch it yourself first and then use your best judgment. Because kids, some kids can handle it and some kids are just far more sensitive to imagery. Yeah, to imagery. And you want to just be respectful of
Well, that's the good news. If you rent it, you get it for 24 hours. So you can't see it twice.
Yeah,
yes,
you can.
You have a 24-hour window and you can rewatch it.
Right. And listeners, too, there's a very nice end story to the Fatima apparition, and that when St. John Paul II was shot in St. Peter's Square on May 13th, 1981, on the Feast of Our Lady of Fatima, he absolutely, as he later said when he was released from the hospital, one hand fired the gun, but another hand directed the bullet. And the doctor said that within, I think, less than an inch, that bullet missed his heart. And he very much credits Our Lady of Fatima for his having survived that assassination attempt. And the bullet that was removed from him was taken to Fatima by the St. John Paul and placed into Our Lady's crown.
Yeah. So it's and the first person I went to on this film before I decided to do it, to say yes, was I went to the Vatican. I flew to the Vatican, and I met with Monsignor Vingano, the head of Vatican Radio and Television, and the second man in the Vatican, and spent about an hour and a half with him, and basically to get the blessing of the Vatican first, because Pope Francis had dedicated his papacy to Our Lady of Fatima.
Yeah, they had. And, it's unusual because so many people have this affection for Our Lady of Lourdes. And and that's probably in large part due to the Bernadette film, which, of course, Jennifer Jones won the Oscar for. Right.
Yes.
And it's that sort of a kinder, gentler Marian apparition. But it's just interesting to see the devotion that sprung up very naturally to Francisco and Jacinta. And oddly enough, in Ireland, of all places, you will find a lot of little girls named Jacinta. And there's a great devotion to her. And she was the first of the three children to die, correct?
Yes. A horrible death from the Spanish flu, from the 1918 pandemic.
Yeah.
Both of them died horrific deaths.
Yeah.
It was dreadful.
Tremendous suffering and no way to relieve it with the sort of aspirin and thing that we have. But my understanding is they were saying, out loud to their parents, we're offering this for sinners. We're offering this for sinners. And it really does make you understand, the capacity that children have not only for sacrifice, but for suffering when it's presented to them in the right way. So again, Rose, as we close out this interview, can you tell us again where the website, the best place for listeners to be able to watch this movie when it comes out on demand?
Yes. You go to your on demand on your televisions, whoever your cable provider is or whatever, and you can go on video on demand or VOD, your VOD channel.
Right.
And it should be there. Eventually, it'll get to the streamers, after that. But there's there's also Universal Pictures will be doing the home entertainment part of it. At some point, it will be available also in DVD, and then it'll go to the Netflix, Amazons of the world after that.
Well,
but in August 28th, it will be video on demand.
Okay, August 28th. Well, listeners, please do keep that in mind. We'll post a link on the show page as well, in case any of you are driving don't want to run this down. Rose, thank you so much for the generous gift of your time. Okay, God bless. And good luck with
the
film. Okay, take care now.
Bye-bye.
All right, listeners, please do stay with us. We'll have former Lake County Sheriff Mark Curran and current Senate candidate Mark Curran on next to discuss this weekend's violence in downtown Chicago and what might be done about it. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
It's been quite a year, hasn't it? Riots, businesses looted and burned, abortion up to the moment of birth, COVID-19 shutdowns, where churches are considered non-essential and a false version of American history is being taught in schools. Yes, this is probably the most important election in our lifetime. The preservation of certain aspects of the Constitution is in jeopardy. What can be done? Pray and fast. Ask for the intercession of our Blessed Mother. Storm heaven with prayer. We can't tell you who to vote for, but we can tell you to vote the teachings of your faith. Winds of Change asks you to vote, preferably vote in person, but vote.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church. And a security person will be on site to register and to participate in the Holy Mass. And for more information, go to ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell.
St. Stanislaus Kostka School has in-person and virtual learning plans for the 2020-21 school year, and scholarships are available. For a virtual tour or more information of St. Stan's School, call 773-278-4560 or 773-270-1553. To see what St. Stan's School has to offer, visit ststanschicago.org. That's ststanschicago.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka School, faith, virtue, valor, an expressway to
welcome
excellence.
Back. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change. And I am so grateful to be joined this second half hour by a man I know who is very busy right now because he is on the campaign trail. But his expertise in issues of law enforcement and in particular dealing with crime and the people who commit them is former Lake County Sheriff Mark Curran, who is also now challenging both Dick Durbin and Willie Wilson, a new person in the race for the U.S. Senate seat. And Sheriff Curran, thank you so much for joining us again. It's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
Yeah, I think we haven't spoken since a third candidate entered the race. At least we haven't spoken on the air about it. And are you getting any feedback from your supporters? Do you think this is going to change? Does this give you a much better shot at defeating Senator Durbin in the fall? I know it's always hard to go up against an incumbent, particularly one who's been there, you know, for decades, as Senator Durbin has been. Are you feeling a new energy to your campaign now that there's a third person?
So what I would say is that we think that you're probably going to need in the low 40s to win, potentially.
Okay.
And there's no way I'm not going to get that. So we have a really good chance to win.
That's terrific.
And, yeah, so Willie Wilson, he's run it only as a Democrat in the past.
Okay.
So he'll peel away from Senator Durbin based on the issues he's running and with stands
right.
on everything.
And he's much loved in the black community in Chicago. He's a self-made millionaire. I happen to, you know, I have respect for a lot of what he has to say. I think he's a very sort of compelling, independent voice in the black community. I really like that about him. But I think, just from my own personal perspective at this point, we really need, with so much social unrest that involves law enforcement, I think we have to have someone with your expertise, longstanding, not only, of course, were you a correctional officer and a sheriff, but you also kept everything, if not at budget, under budget. And those are the two issues facing the people who live in Illinois, are our budget concerns and our taxes, which are driving people from this state, but also this civil unrest and violence that I feel like every Monday, Mark, every guest I talk to, I have to have someone back on again to talk about what happened over the weekend. And there was, it was interesting, my husband and I were out at an event, and I started getting text messages from friends saying, are you okay, are you okay? And I thought, good heavens, what's going on? And then I saw that there was sort of a standoff at Michigan and Wacker. And were you down there for any of that, Sheriff Kern? For that,
yes, I was. I was at a couple Back the Blue rallies.
Okay.
One in Pullman Square.
Okay.
And then another south of there towards Midway.
Okay. And just from your sense of things, how did you feel the police handled the event? I mean, from my point of view, I know they're trying to give a wide berth to people who are expressing frustrations with all sorts of different things. But it seemed to me the first time that the police really sort of stood their ground and didn't overreact. And I know one officer was quite badly hurt, I believe, by someone, walloping them on the head with a skateboard, completely unprovoked. But what's just, you know, as someone who is so well versed in the kinds of tactics that officers should use when faced with this kind of violence, what was your perspective on how the Chicago police handled things on Saturday night?
Yeah, I think Chicago police does a great job. I really think they're good. They're very professional. They've been well trained, and they're at the top of the list as far as departments. You mm-hmm. know, I would put up there. So, they have the budget to train people the right way, and so many people want to get into CPD that they've been able to get some of the best. So what I would say is a couple things. One is people like to take the lowest common denominator, like Jason Van Dyke.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what was going on with him, but, probably some mental health issues. I knew Joe McMahon, the prosecutor, and I knew Dan Herbert, his defense lawyer, both very well. And, ultimately, that's kind of like taking, the worst, I said this the other day, taking Arthur Anderson and how they cooked the books on Enron and everybody lost their life savings.
Right.
Or taking Lehman Brothers and how they, swindled people out of their life savings and tanked the markets and everything else.
Right.
Or taking, you go right down the Catholic Church has had more bad actors than with Roman cowards than the police have.
Well, right.
So why?
That's
so
a very
we
good
want to play
comparison.
These games? Yeah, exactly. So less and less people are applying for jobs in law enforcement. So we want to play these games of taking the lowest common denominator and only applying it to police. And I'm going to say that I think that less people, I know for a fact, less people want to be police officers today than ever before. They work evenings and midnights and weekends and holidays, and there's so much stress and everything else that why would they want to do it? And so more and more young people are saying, I don't want to do it.
No.
And it's a big lie. Everything's premised on a lie.
Right.
75% of the murders in the city of Chicago are black on black. The black people commit a disproportionate amount of crime, that's the world we live in. But I think that up is down, right is wrong, and nobody understands natural law anymore, and nobody operates on objective truth. We're all like emotional feelings, this, that, and the other, and we take one incident and try to make it seem as though that incident is something that's happening every day all across America, which is a total lie.
Right, right. And well,
so you go through the black neighborhoods, and they're dying for police, especially people
right.
who own homes and have little children and what have you. They don't want to surrender their city to these gangbangers.
Right.
So, essentially, the Democratic Party, I was a Democrat a long time, and, I related to Democrats on economic issues, the middle class, the working guy. Catholics historically couldn't get the best jobs, and we had we had unions fighting for us, and the Democrat was the party that fought for us. The Republicans didn't want us.
Right.
But now it's just a different Democratic Party. They're leading the charge. They're all full of lies, and I reject almost every premise that they base anything on.
Yeah. And well, it's, did you, from just from your perspective, I thought that the Chicago police really handled that about as well as they could have. And I thought that finally Superintendent Brown, you know, who walked into a very, very difficult situation, so I'm not faulting him, that he, in releasing the videos and showing, allowing Chicagoans and people who live in the suburbs to see firsthand how the police were attacked and how they responded, I thought that was, I mean, first of all, long overdue. He should have been releasing those kind of things all the time. He may be receiving pressure. My guess would be from further down the chain, from the men and women who, you know, report to him that, listen, you've got to start, if you're not going to defend us and tell our side of the story, who is going to tell it? And so I'm grateful that, I mean, one headline that I saw, I think it was in NBC, that the marchers who were marching to protest police violence were being very protected and quite well by the very police they were protesting against. And I thought, well, there's a breakthrough, you know. And again, you know, having worked for the Catholic Church for so long, I would, of course, you know, you would think that 99 priests out of 100 were, you know, were committing sexual abuse against children. And I think it was a long time before the church finally realized, you know, we have to kind of make the statistics clear without making it look as if we're defending what has happened. And I think the police have finally stepped up to that.
Yeah, I mean, Superintendent Brown, you know, I guess the jury's still out on him. You know, we're always getting better. But, you know, ultimately, there's no major police reforms needed, is what I would say. Man has a fallen nature, and so you can have bad, you know, police officers throughout history. You know, it's the same with, you know, look at the stock market and the bad actors that are in there. You know, I mean,
right.
Driven solely by greed. You know, that's the problem.
Right, right. Well, I know that you have also, and this is why I wanted to have you on the show as well, is because you have tremendous experience in the Hispanic, or I guess what is the preferred term now, the Latinx community, and the difference. You've had some interesting interactions with that community and how they react to either being pulled over by police or their interactions with police. Can you unpack that a little bit? Because I don't think people realize that there is such a distinction between the two communities and how they interact with law enforcement.
Right. So, you know, my experience is, you know, Black people, you know, by and large, you know, they're going to have a iPhone, and when stopped, you know, oftentimes the, you know, iPhone comes on right away, and you know, they have no problems knowing the procedure by which they file complaints and you know, how they address, grievances, and they know the recourse towards essentially everything along the line. They seem to be well-versed in it.
Right.
Whereas Latinos, you know, by and large, they come from countries where the cops were kind of rogue,
mm-hmm.
and they think that they just have to take it, and they're afraid of the police, and they don't know how to complain. They don't know that they can complain.
Okay.
So I've said that if I see any type of discrimination in law enforcement right now, it would definitely be towards the Latino population as opposed to the Black population.
Hmm. And why do you say that? I mean, just simply because they don't feel like they can defend themselves at all when they're pulled over? I mean, what is the difference that the Hispanic people do not pull out their phones and then tape every encounter? Is that the difference, or is it just that kind of culturally they're simply more compliant with law enforcement from the get-go?
Yeah, I would say that culturally that's the case, and they don't identify with, you look at these Black Lives Matter movements, rarely are you ever going to see a Latino that's involved in it. You know, they're not, you know, that's not their experience. But anecdotally, I can certainly tell you that when I've seen instances of racism as the longest serving sheriff in Lake County history and all those years as a prosecutor, it was generally towards Latinos.
Mm-hmm. That's,
you know, it might have been some cop that had a chip on his shoulder that they're illegal or something else or that, and, you know, didn't like that they didn't speak enough English or what have you, and didn't treat them with the same dignity and the respect that you would expect,
mm-hmm.
or that all people should be treated with.
Well, one of the things, Trif, that I've read a lot about is parents saying that, in particular, if they have teenage boys or, you know, boys and their young men as children, and even young women, that they have to have something called the talk with them. And the talk is not about the birds and the bees. The talk, apparently, is what to do when you are pulled over. And if I don't remember my parents saying anything, having to say much to us other than, obviously, you comply with lawful orders. You don't talk back to the police officer. You address him or her with respect. And if you have done something wrong, simply take the ticket and then thank the officer and go on your way. But don't attempt to get into a argumentation or defend yourself. You have boys, I know you have sons. Do you have a version on the talk? What do you say to people when they say to you, what's the proper thing to do when a police officer pulls you over? Because I don't even think they really address that thoroughly in driver's ed.
Right. So I've never had such a conversation with my sons. You know, ultimately they understand who's an authority figure and they understand that they demand respect. And, I am going to believe that despite that they're going to act perfect, in a traffic encounter. It's not because they're white or, this is...
Or because they're privileged.
Propagate these lies.
Right.
Know? Yeah. I mean, there's road cop officers that are going to be nasty to a white guy or a white lady, just like they will to a black guy or a black lady.
Right. And I've had, I know someone who had an experience, was pulled over by a police officer who was, just exceptionally argumentative with him. And he was attempting to explain to the officer why he made the turn he did. And the officer said, well, don't you talk back to me. And here's your, $250 moving violation ticket. And, he said that this is outrageous. This guy was having a bad day and he was taking it out on me. And I wasn't trying to joke with him. I was simply trying to offer an explanation. And
The General Assembly in Illinois makes a routine speeding ticket cost $250. It's not the police officer that does that.
Correct.
So,
right. That's not the
problem. Is that they try to get into your wallet? They're on a typical moving violation. Police don't think that that's right. We would rather that it didn't go to fund all these little pet projects in the General Assembly every time somebody gets speeds. Because, not speeding in a residential neighborhood, it's not, typical police officer does not see that as that serious an offense.
Right. I mean, unless it's like, going 60 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone, or intoxicated.
Right.
I mean, just driving down here today, my husband drove me down here, and there was a man on the Ike just weaving in and out of lanes, drifting over into other lanes. And that's where I really think, hey, where's the state trooper? But, let's talk a little bit about the campaign. How are things going on the campaign trail? And when you're out there, are these the types of issues that you're asked about the most? I know I always go to you because I know you have such an expertise with law enforcement. But what are you hearing from the people in the state of Illinois about what is really worrying them and troubling them? And like, what would the top three issues be?
So I think you're right that, for those of us that are people of faith, and that would be your listeners, that there's really not accidents with God. So, I tend to, my discernment could be off, but I don't think so. There's a reason why in the most, unlawful time in American history that somebody whose background was a county, state, and federal prosecutor and then a long-serving sheriff decided to run for U.S. Senate. And he's running against a guy who's about to defund the police and a guy who doesn't really believe in objective truth and a guy who has done nothing for the poorest neighborhoods in Illinois.
Right.
So,
and how long has Senator Durbin been in office?
38 years.
And is anything... So then, what can he point to have really helped the poor?
Right.
So
then we have Willie Wilson in the race. And he's a black gentleman, as you said, that... is basically running on the reparations, but also just the idea that Dick Durbin's done nothing for the black community.
Mm-hmm.
That is completely true.
Is it? Okay.
So like I said, I've been down to, you've seen Lewis recently, and you look at what, that's the worst town in America. It does not look like America. It's absolutely unbelievable. If you haven't been there, you got to go see it. It's incredible. to believe that that's America. So then you have, so those are big issues right there. I think a lot of people are concerned about liberty, that the government feels like they can just, tell citizens, whatever to do whatever they want, and there doesn't seem to be a constitutional basis. So the fact that I was a longtime constitutional law professor and understand that our founding documents, people are glad about that I'll be able to push back. I think also people are sick of just the hyper partisanship,
right?
And having been an elected Democrat and now a Republican, and really just trying to be Catholic, not trying to be faithful to any party platform.
Mm-hmm.
People see that somebody tried to say, well, why are the Republicans in favor of the death penalty? And my response is, well, I'm not,
Right.
Why are the Republicans, don't care about, school lunch programs? And I say, well, I do.
Right.
I believe that, we have a responsibility towards all, that this individualism concept that was pushed on America and a lot of people try to promote is not really Catholic. So I'm not.
Yeah, and I have to say, you're so distinct. You're so distinct among I think all sorts of different, candidates. But in particular, because you are a Republican, I think you have really embodied as a candidate and as an elected official a consistent ethic of life, where you oppose the death penalty. You have a very kind of progressive viewpoint on dealing with legal immigration and on immigration reform, but you are pro-life on abortion. And however, you're also very outspoken on behalf of, say, homeless vets. I really like how you have taken, concern for human beings from the moment of conception until the moment of natural death, and you really see human dignity as the issue. So, Sheriff Kern, where can people go if they want to help, volunteer, make a contribution, or otherwise be involved?
Yeah, Mary, so it's electcurren.com.
Electcurren.com, okay.
We have not gotten $1 of PAC money.
Wonderful.
Big donors are not, because we're going to be responsible for the citizens and not for the elite.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you'll be able to come back on again. Sheriff Kern, again, always a joy to be with you. Listeners, thanks so much for staying with us through the hour. God bless you and have a wonderful week.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed. What's that you say? Become so obscure, it does not take the